educated men, mostly Oxford graduates, who could serve as Rhodes's clones. After months of indoctrination, they were dispatched to the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and British colonies throughout the world. In time, the kindergarten proved itself capable of populating the next generation of the secret society. A Rothschild lackey. As the High Commissioner for South Africa and the first governor of the Transvaal and Orange River Colony, Milner drafted a plan at the behest of Lord Rothschild to transform the territory of Uganda into a homeland for the Jews. This was the territory that Rhodes required for his Cairo to Cape Town railroad. A Zion in Central Africa would grant Britain control of the headwaters of the Nile and, therefore, a means of driving foreign interests from the continent. Milner retired from political office in 1905. He returned to England to assume a position of director at the Joint Stock Bank, which was owned by Lord Rothschild. He, together with Rothschild, continued to supervise the Round Table movement, which had established branches in Australia, New Zealand, and Canada. The movement now published the Round Table, its own quarterly magazine. The names of the editors and writers were never mentioned. The Rhodes Scholars. Along with Lord Rothschild, Milner was also co-executor of the Rhodes Estate and an administrator of the Rhodes Scholarships. These postgraduate awards for study at Oxford University were granted to young colonists with the purpose of instilling into their minds the advantages of the colonies, as well as to England, for the retention of the unity of the empire. The lion's share of the awards were singled out for enterprising American scholars. At the completion of their 2 years at Oxford, these scholars were to return to the United States so that they could obtain prominent positions in academics, politics, and the media. In this way, they could serve to undermine the nation's sovereignty. As soon as the Rhodes Fund was established, massive amounts of money poured into its coffers from the estate of Alfred Beit, the Carnegie United Kingdom Trust, and organizations associated with J.P. Morgan and John D. Rockefeller. By 1915, the impact of the Rhodes Scholars in America was decried by William Fulton of the Chicago Herald Tribune as follows.
Rhodes Scholars dominate the United States Department of State, which directs the doling out of billions in foreign aid, with the United Kingdom getting the major share. The savants also hold down important positions in the Economic Cooperation Administration, mutual defense assistance programs, and other foreign handout setups.
Despite this warning, the infiltration of Rhodes Scholars into top political positions in the U.S. government persisted throughout the 20th century. These scholars came to include Dean Rusk, Secretary of State, 1961 to 1969. Walt Whitman Rostow, Special Assistant for National Security Affairs, 1966 to 1969. Harlan Cleveland, Assistant Secretary of State for International Organization Affairs in the Kennedy Administration, Ambassador to NATO under Presidents Johnson and Nixon. Nicholas Katzenbach, U.S. Attorney General, 1965 to 1966. Senator James William Fulbright, Arkansas, 1945 to 1974. Senator Frank Church, Idaho, 1956 to 1981. Senator Bill Bradley, New Jersey, 1979 to 1997. Senator David Boren, Oklahoma, 1979 to 1994. Senator Richard D. Lugar, Indiana, 1976 to 2013. Senator Larry Pressler, South Dakota, 1979 to 1997. Senator Paul Sarbanes, Maryland, 1977 to 2007. Representative Elliot H. Levitas, Georgia, 1975 to 1985. Representative Carl Albert, Ohio, 1947 to 1977. Speaker of the House, 1971 to 1977. Representative John Brademas, Indiana, 1959 to 1981, later New York University President. President William Jefferson Clinton, Arkansas Governor, 1979 to 1981, 1983 to 1982. President, 1993-2001. Governor Richard Celeste, Ohio, 1983-1991. Supreme Court Justice Byron Whizzer White, 1962-1993. General Bernard W. Rogers, Supreme Commander of the NATO Forces in Europe, 1979-1987. General Wesley Clark, Supreme Commander of the NATO Forces in Europe, 1997-2000. Stansfield Turner, CIA Director, 1977-1981. R. James Woolsey, CIA Director, 1993-1995. Charles Collingwood, TV Commentator. Howard K. Smith, TV Commentator. George Jerome Goodman, writer known as Adam Smith. Hedley Donovan, former editor-in-chief of Time magazine, later a senior advisor to President Carter. Robert Penn Warren, Pulitzer Prize-winning poet and novelist, best known for his book All the King's Men. Eyeing the Conquest of America. America continued to remain the central focus of the secret society that came about because of a brainstorm. By the time the tombstone for Rhodes was set in place on a hill in the Matobos, J.P. Morgan had been persuaded by Nathan Rothschild to establish a central bank in the United States as a counterpart to the Bank of England and to serve as a founding member of the Pilgrim Society in New York. Cornelius Vanderbilt was called upon by Rothschild and Lord Rosebery to become a pilgrim and to dedicate a portion of his wealth to the grandiose endeavor of forging a one-world government. Waldorf Astor, the New York real estate tycoon, was recruited by Milner and Lord Brett to become a key member of the British Round Table. Andrew Carnegie, arguably America's richest man, was persuaded by Lord Rosebery and William Stead to devote much of his vast fortune to further the cause of a one-world government. Behind such men of wealth and influence, the House of Rothschild loomed in the shadows. Against such forces, a backwoods character like Uncle Sam didn't have a ghost of a chance. Part 2. The New World.
Some of the biggest men in the United States in the field of commerce and manufacture are afraid of something. They know that there is a power, somewhere, so organized, so subtle, so watchful, so interlocked, so complete, so pervasive, that they had better not speak above their breath when they speak in condemnation of it.
Woodrow Wilson.
The democracy will cease to exist when you take away from those who are willing to work and give to those who would not.
Thomas Jefferson.
The world is governed by very different personages from what is imagined by those who are not behind the scenes.
English Prime Minister Benjamin Disraeli in 1844. 7. Converting Carnegie.
Behind the invisible government, there is an invisible government upon the throne that owes the people no loyalty and recognizes no responsibility. To destroy this invisible government, to undo the ungodly union between corrupt business and corrupt politics, is the task of a statesman.
Theodore Roosevelt, Presidential Campaign of 1912. At the turn of the 20th century, Andrew Carnegie was the richest man in America. He made his fortune in partnership with George Pullman, who sold railroad cars to the railroad companies. Carnegie next purchased a string of steel mills in Pittsburgh to form Carnegie Steel, which became a vertically integrated business, the prototype for the modern industrial corporation. The company owned not only the mills where the steel was made, but also the mines where the iron ore was extracted, and the coal mines that supplied the coal. It controlled the ships and the railroads that transported the iron ore and the coal to the factories. The company also developed its managerial pool internally from the bottom up, rather than hiring managers from other businesses. In 1883, Carnegie fell under the spell of Herbert Spencer, whom he met at a dinner in the great British philosopher's honor at Delmonico's restaurant in New York. He sought out Spencer's company whenever he visited London and showered the philosopher with lavish presents, including a grand piano. In his autobiography, Carnegie claimed that it was with Spencer's help that he finally
got rid of theology and the supernatural and found the truth of evolution.
Through Spencer, the American steel magnate met and befriended Matthew Arnold, the esteemed British poet, social commentator, and agnostic. Arnold maintained that the notion of a personal God is
unintelligible and unverifiable,
a stance which Carnegie adopted. Rosebery and Stead. During his visits to London, Carnegie was soon rubbing elbows with the British ruling elite, including Prime Minister William Gladstone and Lord Archibald Primrose, the 5th Earl of Rosebery, who was Lord Nathan Rothschild's son-in-law. A member of Rhodes's Society of the Elect, Rosebery served as Britain's Prime Minister from 1894 to 1895. When Rosebery visited America in the spring of 1883, Carnegie served as his tour guide and secured a private train to show the British aristocrat the anthracite deposits and collieries of eastern Pennsylvania, the natural oil fields of western Pennsylvania, and the steel rail mills of Pittsburgh, the dirtiest place on earth. The tour was such a success that Rosebery offered to put his American friend up for a seat in the House of Commons as a representative from Edinburgh, an offer which Carnegie rejected. Carnegie met Stead in the fall of 1883 at a dinner party hosted in London by Dolly Thompson, the wife of the owner of the Pall Mall Gazette, where Stead served as the editor. Stead, who liked to bask in the company of the rich and powerful, sought Carnegie's favor. He defended Carnegie's suppression of the striking steelworkers in Homestead, Pennsylvania, lavished praise on the industrialists' literary efforts, and even served as Carnegie's caddy at Skibo Castle, the American millionaire's 40,000-acre estate in Scotland. The Great Rapprochement. Through Rosebery and Stead, Carnegie became familiar with the plans of Cecil Rhodes to bring about the reunification of Great Britain and the United States. In Triumphant Democracy, which was published in London in 1886, Carnegie wrote,
"Let men say what they will. I say that as surely as the sun in the heavens once shone upon Britain and America united, so surely it is one morning to rise, to shine upon, to greet again the reunited states, the British-American Union." This great rapprochement, he believed, was inevitable for racial reasons. The American, he argued, remains three-fourths purely British. The mixture of the German, which constitutes substantially all of the remainder, though not strictly British, is yet Germanic. The Briton of today is himself composed in large measure of the Germanic element, and German, Briton, and American are all of the Teutonic race.
Once the British-American Union came into being, Carnegie believed, it would dominate the world and establish universal peace.
"Such a giant among pygmies as the British-American Union," he wrote, "would never need to exert its power, but only to intimate its wishes and decisions."
American supremacy. But Carnegie stood in opposition to the Society of the Elect's claim that England must rule the world. America, in his estimation, had come to supersede Great Britain in wealth, industrial and agricultural production, and inventiveness. He wrote,
"Many of the most important practical inventions which have contributed to the progress of the world have originated with Americans. No other people have devised so many labor-saving machines and appliances. The first commercially successful steamboat navigated the Hudson, and the first steamboat to cross the Atlantic sailed under the American flag from an American port. Americans gave the world the cotton gin and the first practical mowing, reaping, and sowing machines. In the most spiritual, most ethereal of all departments in which man has produced great triumphs, namely electricity, the position of the American is specially noteworthy."
What's more, America displayed a higher literacy rate, produced the greatest number of newspapers, and established political institutions that were comparatively pure and free from corruption. For this reason, the United States must spearhead the effort to create a one-world government. Britain, he insisted, possessed no other choice but to reunite with her giant child in order to avoid sure decline to comparative insignificance in the future annals of the English-speaking race. While Rosebery blanched at the notion of American supremacy in the new order of things, Stead embraced it and presented Carnegie's argument to Cecil Rhodes.
Rhodes, Stead wrote, expressed his readiness to adopt the course from which he had at first recoiled, that of securing the unity of the English-speaking race by consenting to the absorption of the British Empire in the American Union if it could not be secured any other way. He expressed his deliberate conviction that English-speaking reunion was so great an end in itself as to justify even the sacrifice of the distinctive features and independent existence of the British Empire.
Although they never met, Carnegie and Rhodes shared much in common. Both men were Freemasons. Carnegie was instrumental in obtaining the most complete collection of published works by and about Scottish poet Robert Burns, an ardent Freemason, for the Library of the Supreme Council of the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry in Washington, D.C. Both were avowed agnostics. Both espoused the doctrine of evolution and the survival of the fittest. Both possessed an interest in the occult. Carnegie, as a young man, had been a Swedenborgian, a religious cult with ties to theosophy. Both, despite their vast wealth, were socialists. In an interview with the New York Times, Carnegie said,
"I believe socialism is the grandest theory ever presented, and I am sure some day it will rule the world. Then we will have obtained the millennium. That is the state we are drifting into. Then men will be content to work for the general welfare and share their riches with their neighbor."
And both had ties to the house of Rothschild. Carnegie Steel had been financed by Jacob Schiff, who worked in tandem with the European Rothschilds, and Schiff, at the instigation of Lord Rothschild, would introduce Carnegie to J.P. Morgan. The Gospel of Wealth. Thanks to his association with members of the Society of the Elect, Carnegie developed his
Gospel of Wealth,
which he first proclaimed in an article that appeared in an 1889 edition of the North American Review. While the government should supervise the distribution of wealth and provide for the needs of its citizenry, he reasoned, a cadre of millionaires should preside over the government.
The emergence of such a ruling elite, he insisted, was the beneficent necessity of human evolution. The gap between the rich and the poor, he argued in the article, was inevitable and caused by laws of nature that were immutable. But the same laws of nature dictated that the wealthy, with their talent for organization and management, were obliged to use their surplus revenue to benefit the vast majority of mankind, who had evolved into serviceable drones.
In exchange for such public benefactions, the men of means should be afforded the right to determine public policy concerning trusts, tariffs, monopoly, and regulation. With this gospel, Carnegie provided the blueprint for the formation of a shadow government that was to rule over America. The Prince of Peace. After Carnegie sold his steel company to J.P. Morgan for $480 million, the highest price ever paid for a business at the time, Stead persuaded the industrialist to provide the funding, $40 million in today's money, for the construction of the Peace Palace at The Hague to house a
permanent court of arbitration. The task of this court would be to settle disputes between nations and to bring about the complete banishment of war.
The construction of the Peace Palace represented the first attempt to dissolve national sovereignty and national law under an institution with global jurisdiction. When the building was completed, Carnegie called it
the most holy building in the world.
Carnegie now embarked on a crusade to create a League of Peace, or League of Nations, which would comprise a combination of the leading imperial powers, complete with an international police force. He even publicized his proposal in a short article entitled A League of Nations, which appeared in the pages of Outlook magazine, May 25, 1907.
The creation of such an organization, Carnegie realized, would require control of America's educational and political institutions, control that could only be achieved by the expenditure of vast sums of cash from a charitable foundation. These institutions would become reliant on these benefactions for their continued existence, and the trustees of the foundation thereby would gain control over their operation. In 1910, the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, CEIP, set up its headquarters in Washington, D.C. Carnegie appointed 28 trustees, including Elihu Root, senator from New York and former Secretary of War, Harvard President Charles W. Eliot, shipping and real estate magnate Robert Brookings, former ambassador to Great Britain Joseph H. Choate, former Secretary of State John W. Foster, Cleveland Hoadley Dodge, president of Phelps Dodge, James T. Shotwell, professor of history at Columbia University, and Nicholas Murray Butler, president of Columbia University. CEIP displayed Carnegie's continual close ties to J.P. Morgan, to whom he had sold his steel company. Throughout the first decade of the 20th century, the ties between the two industrialists tightened. Root, who became CEIP's first president, was Morgan's personal lawyer, while Cleveland Hoadley Dodge was a director of the Morgan-owned National City Bank in New York, and Joseph H. Choate served as one of Morgan's corporate lawyers, and Morgan remained under the control of the Rothschilds. 8. The Rise of Foundations.
The foundation's direct power is the power of money. Privately financed educational institutions have had a bad time during the period of rapidly increasing costs. Foundation grants have become so important a source of support that college and university presidents cannot often afford to ignore the opinions and wishes of the executives who distribute foundation largesse. Such administrators will freely admit that they do not like to receive restricted or earmarked grants and would far prefer to be unfettered in their disposition of money given to their institutions. But they will also admit that they usually dare not turn down a grant, however inconsistent with their policy, priority of goals, or urgent needs it may be, for fear they might earn the displeasure of the granting foundation.
René Wormser, Foundations, Their Power and Influence. Knowing the rise of global government required social engineering, the Carnegie Foundation for the Advancement of Teaching, CFAT, which was established in 1905, gained control of America's educational system. The original purpose of the foundation was
to provide retiring pensions for teachers of universities, colleges, and technical schools, without regard to race, sex, creed, or color.
The foundation also provided general endowments to institutions that complied with its prescribed scholastic standards and entrance requirements. By 1909, the CFAT had become the national unofficial accrediting agency for colleges and universities. It possessed the power to create the curricula, to oversee the faculty, and to supervise the actions of the administration. Since Carnegie was an avowed socialist, an agnostic, a globalist, and an associate of the Rhodes Society, universities throughout America began to reflect his ideology and beliefs. In Foundations, Their Power and Influence, René Wormser, special counsel to the Rees Commission, wrote, "The growing radicalism which was beginning rapidly to permeate academic circles was no grassroots movement. Mr. Aaron Sargent cited a statement by Professor Ludwig von Mises that socialism does not spring from the masses, but is instigated by intellectuals that form themselves into a clique and bore from within and operate that way. It is not a people's movement at all. It is a capitalization on the people's emotions and sympathies toward a point these people wish to reach." the Sword of Damocles. Funding from the CFAT came to hang over the country's institutions of higher learning like the Sword of Damocles. Those who complied with the dictates of the Foundation's trustees received massive benefactions. Those who failed to comply did not. New subjects became mandatory college courses, including anthropology, comparative religions, and social science, all of which served to stress the relativity of cultural practices and ideals. The need to introduce such subjects had been brought on by the advent of the global conflict. Students had to be conditioned to abandon the isolationist stance of their fathers and forefathers before they could be expected to engage in a war on European soil. The effects of the Carnegie Foundation on America's religious colleges were decried as follows in a speech delivered by Thomas W. Churchill, president of the New York Board of Education, on June 14, 1914.
Mr. Carnegie's efforts are crushing individuality out of American colleges and lessening their contributions to public service. The Carnegie Foundation has deliberately and conspicuously made a mark of religious colleges, particularly of the small institutions which, in their own field, carried on a great Samaritan work, with limited equipment but a splendid spirit. One after another, many religious colleges have been seduced by great wealth to give up the independence that should have been found in a college, if nowhere else, and to forsake the faith of their founders. It makes me boil with shame to think that in this generation and in this republic, any body of men would so blazingly employ the tremendous power of great wealth as to permit it to buy the abandonment of religion.
At the same time, Ernest Victor Hollis, the chief of college administration in the U.S. Department of Education, also voiced his objection to the sinister influence of CFAT. The method used by the endowment, he said, was one of indirection,
indirectly through general and non-controversial purposes. For instance, Hollis elaborated, there is little connection between giving a pension to a college professor or giving a sum to the general endowment of his college and reforming entrance requirements, the financial practices, and the scholastic standards of his institution.
Yet, he insisted, the one was bound to the other. It was a case of conform or no grant. When to conform meant bathing in a stream of millions, Hollis concluded that college and university administrators and their faculties were inclined to conform. The General Education Board. Carnegie was not alone in seeking control of the American political and educational systems to further a new world order. John D. Rockefeller was greatly impressed by Carnegie's philanthropy, and when the Carnegie Library opened in Pittsburgh, he sent this congratulatory note.
I would that more men of wealth were doing as you are doing with your money. But be assured, your example will bear fruits, and the time will come when men of wealth will more generally be willing to use it for the good of others.
In 1905, Rockefeller, with Frederick Gates, his investment manager, created the General Education Board, GEB, that came with an ultimate price tag of $129 million. The task of this organization was spelled out by Gates as follows.
In our dreams, we have limitless resources, and the people yield themselves with perfect docility to our molding hands. The present education conventions fade from their minds, and unhampered by tradition, we work our own goodwill upon a grateful and responsive rural folk. We shall not try to make these people or any of their children into philosophers or men of learning or men of science. We have not to raise up from among them authors, editors, poets, or men of letters. We shall not search for embryo great artists, painters, musicians, nor lawyers, doctors, preachers, politicians, statesmen, of whom we have an ample supply. The task we set before ourselves is very simple, as well as a very beautiful one. To train these people as we find them to a perfectly ideal life just where they are,
So we will organize our children and teach them to do in a perfect way the things their fathers and mothers are doing in an imperfect way, in the homes, in the shops, and on the farm.
In compliance with GEB guidelines, blacks would receive vocational training since they were intellectually inferior to whites and, therefore, ill-equipped to meet academic challenges. Gates wrote,
"Latin, Greek, and metaphysics form a kind of knowledge that I fear with our colored brethren tend to puff up rather than build up."
The American educational system was to serve not only as a branch of industry, but also as a tool for governance. Standardized education. In no time at all, the GEB was working in tandem with the CFAT to develop standardized curricula with standardized textbooks for all American children. This development was to be expected, since Daniel Gilman, one of GEB's four incorporators, was also the president of the Carnegie Institution of Washington. Nevertheless, it provoked considerable public outcry. In 1914, the newly formed National Education Association passed this resolution.
"We view with alarm the activity of the Carnegie and Rockefeller Foundations, agencies not in any way responsible to the people, in their efforts to control the policies of our state educational institutions, to fashion after their conception and to standardize our courses of study, and to surround the institutions with conditions which menace true academic freedom and defeat the primary purpose of democracy as heretofore preserved inviolate in our common schools, normal schools, and universities."
The Rockefeller Foundation was set up in 1913 with an initial $100 million endowment to promote the well-being of mankind throughout the world. The nebulous nature of this charter gave the Rockefeller family carte blanche to manipulate the foundation to feather its own nest. As soon as the charter was approved, Rockefeller dumped an additional $82.8 million into the foundation's coffers, thereby insulating a large portion of his vast wealth from federal and state taxation. Since the family business was oil production and refinement, millions of dollars were contributed by the Rockefeller Foundation to the American Petroleum Institute, a trade association whose chief function was lobbying for tariffs on imported oil and arranging marketing agreements between the various oil companies. Junior's indoctrination. John D. Rockefeller, Jr., who served as the first president of the Rockefeller Foundation, retained a very close relationship with Carnegie, whom he held in avuncular affection. Junior spent several weeks every summer at Skibo and agreed with Carnegie that their foundations should direct their resources toward common global goals. Carnegie's last public appearance was at a gathering of Junior's Bible class at the Fifth Avenue Baptist Church in New York. The appearance was telling, since Carnegie was instrumental in persuading Junior to shed his religious fundamentalism. Shortly after Carnegie addressed the Bible class, Junior announced to the group his belief that anyone who manifested the moral spirit of Jesus merited entrance into the kingdom of heaven, even if he or she refused to practice Christian rituals. Junior's internationalism was further enhanced by his friendship with Raymond B. Fosdick, who became his lawyer and closest advisor. Fosdick had been appointed to serve as Undersecretary of the League of Nations by President Wilson. In his fawning biography, John D. Rockefeller, Jr., A Portrait, 1956, Fosdick wrote,
"More and more, Mr. Rockefeller began to think in international terms. It is true that he had not favored the League of Nations when it was first proposed. Just as he had taken his church affiliations from his father, so his political loyalties were similarly inherited, and he had followed the Republican Party in its opposition to President Wilson. But his opinions were invariably marked by tolerance, and inflexibility was not part of his character."
Rewriting history. Before the outbreak of World War I, Carnegie and Junior came to an understanding. The Carnegie Endowment would center on international education, while the Rockefeller Foundation would focus on national education. Both men agreed that the key to conditioning the American people for war required a drastic rewriting of American history. In textbooks throughout the country, England became the mother country, who watched over her American sons and daughters with loving affection. No longer were the British portrayed as the oppressors of the American colonists, nor were they presented as tyrants who engaged in the brutal practice of impressment that sparked the War of 1812. The contributions of Germans to the building of America were greatly downplayed. German was banned from school curricula, and the music of German composers was eliminated from school repertories. University professors and high school teachers who objected to these changes or opposed the war were fired or cowed into silence. Ground zero for the educational reforms was the Rockefeller-funded Columbia Teachers College, where Harold Rugg, a distinguished professor, said,
"Through schools of the world we shall disseminate a new conception of government, one that will embrace all the collective activities of men, one that will postulate the need for scientific control and operation of economic activities."
Glimpsing Evil. One of the first glimpses into the inherent nefarious nature of the Carnegie and Rockefeller Foundation's influence came in 1912. When the Commission on Industrial Relations studied labor conditions and the treatment of workers by the major U.S. industrial firms. Starting with a study of labor exploitation, the Commission on Industrial Relations went on to investigate concentrations of economic power, interlocking directorates, and the role of the then relatively new large charitable foundations. Questions arose from the fact that Junior appointed William Lyon King to serve as the head of the Rockefeller Foundation's Department of Industrial Relations. King's main task was not to further the goal of compromise between labor and industry, but rather to defend Junior's role in the Ludlow Massacre, a labor dispute which resulted in the deaths of 2 men and 11 children. During the commission hearings, future Supreme Court Justice Louis D. Brandeis testified that he was seriously concerned about the emerging danger of such a concentration of power. He said,
"When a great financial power has developed which can successfully summon forces from all parts of the country to carry out what they deem to be their business principle, there develops within the state, a state so powerful that the ordinary social and industrial forces existing are insufficient to cope with it."
The Commission's report concluded that,
"As regards the foundations created for unlimited general purposes and endowed with enormous resources, their ultimate possibilities are so grave a menace that it would be desirable to recommend their abolition."
Denying Christ. But no efforts were undertaken by government officials to curtail their activities, let alone to abolish the foundations. This permitted Junior to use his tax-exempt organization to further the development of a one-world religion. Under the influence of the Reverend Harry Emerson Fosdick, Raymond's elder brother, he funded and spearheaded the Interchurch Movement, ICM, which sought to consolidate the Protestant churches into a corporate-like structure that would exercise control over their activities. The ideology of the ICM sprang from the sermons of the Reverend Fosdick, who had become indoctrinated in the employment of higher criticism to the New Testament by Charles Briggs, his professor at Union Theological Seminary. Fosdick believed that Christianity should be demythologized and stripped of all theological accretions, including the virgin birth, the miracles, and the resurrection, so that the kerygma, or original message, of the historic Jesus could be recaptured for modern man. As a young pastor in Lower Manhattan, Fosdick came upon the social gospel of Walter Rauschenbusch, who taught that Christianity, in its nature revolutionary, that Jesus did not perform an act of atonement on the cross, and that the kingdom of heaven is not a matter of getting into heaven, but of transforming life on earth into the harmony of heaven. This was the message, Fosdick believed, that could unite all of mankind. The message struck a chord with Junior, who in a 1917 speech at the Baptist Social Union had said that a new, unified church would pronounce ordinance, ritual, creed as non-essential for admission into the kingdom of God or his church. Harry Emerson Fosdick and Jr. became bound together after Fosdick delivered a sermon called Shall the Fundamentalists Win? At the First Presbyterian Church in New York. In the sermon, the Reverend Fosdick denounced interpretations of the Bible which upheld the supernatural aspects of the life of Jesus as intolerant. When the congregation reacted to the sermon by demanding Fosdick's ouster as their pastor, Jr. rallied to Fosdick's support and distributed copies of the sermons to ministers and seminarians throughout the country. In addition, he arranged for Fosdick to be selected as the senior pastor of the Riverside Church in Upper Manhattan, which had been constructed by the Rockefeller Foundation at a cost of $4 million. With the Fosdick brothers at his side, Jr. initiated a policy of funding seminaries that complied with the dictates of higher criticism and the debunking of the New Testament. A new breed of minister, who believed neither the account of the resurrection nor the divinity of Jesus, was unleashed on the American people. The seeds of doubt and skepticism would be spread from sea to shining sea, so that deeply held convictions would be surrendered for the sake of ecumenism.
9. New American Pilgrims. What an extraordinary episode in the economic progress of man that age was, which came to an end in August 1914. The projects and politics of militarism and imperialism, of radical and cultural rivalries, of monopolies, restrictions, and exclusion, which were to play the serpent to this garden of paradise, were little more than the amusements of the daily newspaper, and appeared to exercise almost no influence at all on the ordinary course of social and economic life, the internationalization of which was nearly complete in practice.
John Maynard Keynes, The Economic Consequences of Peace. The task of creating a secret society in America to advance the goals of Cecil Rhodes was left to J.P. Morgan. In 1854, the Morgan Bank had been established in London by two American financiers, George Peabody and Junius Morgan. The Rothschilds developed a close relationship with Peabody and Morgan, and following a financial crash in 1857, they saved the Morgan Bank by organizing a bailout from the Bank of England. The Morgan Bank, with unlimited funding from the Rothschilds, became the driving force behind Western expansion in the United States. It financed and controlled westbound railroads through voting trusts. In 1879, Cornelius Vanderbilt's New York Central Railroad, which was financed by J.P. Morgan, Junius's son, gave preferential shipping rates to John D. Rockefeller's budding Standard Oil monopoly, thereby cementing the Rockefeller-Morgan relationship and the formation of a new cartel. In 1904, economic analyst John Moody, founder of Moody's Investor Services, said it was impossible to talk of Rockefeller, Carnegie, and Morgan interests as separate. Enter J.P. Morgan. Like Carnegie, Rhodes, and members of the Society of the Elect, J.P. Morgan was an Anglophile, a Freemason, and a practitioner of the occult. Raised in England, the young Morgan regularly consulted famed fortune-teller Evangeline Adams, and later in his life planned an expedition to Egypt to explore the supernatural origins of the ancient mystery religions. Through his business connection with Lord Nathan Rothschild, Morgan became acquainted with members of the Society of the Elect, including Lord Alfred Milner. In 1901, Morgan offered Milner a then-massive income of $100,000 per annum to become a partner in the London branch. But Milner, who was then serving as the administrator of the Transvaal, would not be distracted from the vital business of the Boer War. The Pilgrim Society. In 1903, at the bidding of Rothschild and Milner, Morgan established the American chapter of the Pilgrim Society at the Waldorf Astoria in New York. The purpose of this clandestine club, whose motto was Hic et Ubique, here and everywhere, was to further the Anglo-American Union. The London headquarters of the Society had been set up as a spin-off of the Society of the Elect and catered to the rich and influential, including Alfred Milner, Lord Rosebery, Robert Brand of the Lazard Bank, Waldorf Astor, Alfred Bite, and Charles Dawes. The New York chapter included such notables as Elihu Root, Thomas W. Lamont, Percy Rockefeller, Ogden Mills Reed, Otto Kahn, Andrew Mellon, W.B. Whitney, Cornelius Vanderbilt, Vincent Astor, Mortimer I. Schiff, Frank Vanderlip, Henry Davison, Charles D. Norton, Nelson Aldrich, and Paul Warburg. Joseph Choate, the Morgan lawyer who became CEIP trustee, was one of the Society's founding fathers, and Nicholas Murray Butler, another founder, would emerge several years later as a CEIP trustee. The interlocking interest of the group was best exemplified by Root, who became instrumental not only in the work of the Carnegie and Rockefeller Foundations, but also in the creation of the League of Nations and the Council on Foreign Relations. Similarly, the fact that the Pilgrims were controlled by the Rothschild money cartel was verified by the presence of Paul Warburg. Warburg, a prominent member of the Warburg Banking Consortium in Germany, which was allied to the House of Rothschild, had married Nina Loeb, the daughter of one of the founders of Kuhn, Loeb & Company, a financial firm tightly connected to Rothschild. The incredible importance of this dining club to the future of America became clear in 1910, when prominent pilgrims including Warburg, Vanderlip, Davison, Norton, and Aldrich set off for Jekyll Island off the coast of Georgia to plan the formation of the Federal Reserve System. A clandestine society. The pilgrims from the London and New York societies were welcomed guests at each other's clubs and shared in each other's efforts to advance a concept that they called the New World Order. The meaning of this phrase was clarified by William Lyon Mackenzie King, the Premier of Canada, in his dinner address to New York pilgrims in 1912. King envisioned a future in which the world would be united in peace and harmony under an Anglo-American alliance.
When victory and peace came, he prophesied, the peoples of the British Commonwealth and of the United States would be united more closely than ever, as all the nations who have united in the defense of freedom would remain united in the defense of mankind.
These remarks prompted Andrew Carnegie, one of the leading members of the society, to stand up and cheer. The meetings of the Pilgrim Society were held in secret. No guests were allowed to attend, no minutes were kept, no financial records were disclosed. Proof of the commitment of members to the cause of their society came in 1919, when U.S. Pilgrim Irving T. Bush plunked down the funding for the Bush House in downtown London. Cut from Portland stone at a cost of $20 million, it was at the time the most expensive building in the world. To dispel any doubts about the purpose of the building, Bush commissioned the erection of a large statue at its entrance of two semi-naked men holding aloft the torch of liberty while brandishing two swords. One sword was emblazoned with lions, the other with eagles. The inscription read, "To the Friendship of English-Speaking Peoples." 37 years after its founding, an obscure American journalist took notice of the clandestine club. In 1940, in Sir Uncle Sam, Knight of the British Empire, a book that sold less than 500 copies, John Whitford wrote, "There are several curious things about these pilgrim functions. In the first place, there is present at these dinners an array of notables, such as it would be impossible to bring together under one roof for any other purpose and by any other society. Among the guests were John D. Rockefeller and J. P. Morgan, Thomas W. Lamont, and other members of the House of Morgan. We are entitled to know what the Pilgrim Society is, what it stands for,
and who these powerful pilgrims are that can call out the great to hear a British ambassador expound to Americans the virtues of a united democratic front.
The lack of public interest in the workings of the Pilgrim Society through the years remained mind-boggling, since its members would come to include John Foster Dulles, Allen Dulles, General George Marshall of the Marshall Plan, W. Averill Harriman, Joseph P. Kennedy, Henry Luce, founder of Time magazine, Henry Kissinger, General Alexander Haig, William Paley, CBS president, Walter Cronkite, Sandra Day O'Connor, Elliot Richardson, Jacob Schiff, Paul Volcker, and David Rockefeller. The American Roundtable. In 1912, the Pilgrim Society spawned the American Roundtable. Stead's mission resulted in ultimate success. Its founding fathers were George Louis Beer, an associate of J.P. Morgan, who served as a professor of British history at Columbia University. Walter Lippmann, editor of the New Republic and the author of Woodrow Wilson's 14-point speech, Jerome D. Green, chief executive officer of the London branch of Lee, Higginson and Company, and a trustee of the Rockefeller Foundation, Frank Adelot, a Rhodes Scholar and president of Swarthmore College, Whitney Shepherdson, a Rhodes Scholar and director of the Carnegie Corporation's British and Colonies Fund, Thomas Lamont, a partner of J.P. Morgan Company, and Edwin D. Canham, a Rhodes Scholar and editor of the Christian Science Monitor. Their names displayed the coalescence of wealth and power between the houses of Morgan, Rockefeller, and Carnegie, with the Rhodes Trust and the Rothschild Cartel. Planning to attend the opening ceremony of this new extension of the society, which had been created by Rhodes, William T. Stead boarded the Titanic and passed into history. 10. The Duck Hunters.
The composition of the Jekyll Island meeting was a classic example of cartel structure. A cartel is a group of independent businesses which join together to coordinate the production, pricing, or marketing of their members. The purpose of a cartel is to reduce competition and thereby increase profitability. This is accomplished through a shared monopoly over their industry. Here at Jekyll Island were representatives of the world's leading banking consortia: Morgan, Rockefeller, Rothschild, Warburg, and Kuhn Loeb. They were often competitors, and there is little doubt that there was considerable distrust among them. But they were driven together by one overriding desire to fight their common enemy. The enemy was competition.
G. Edward Griffin, The Creature from Jekyll Island. Planning the Fed. The House of Morgan, which remained bound to the House of Rothschild, emerged as the dominant force in the creation of a deep state which would rule the United States from the shadows. It gave rise to the Pilgrim Society and the American Roundtable, and it would strip the country of liberty by fashioning the Federal Reserve System. From the time of its creation, on December 23, 1913, the Fed represented the ultimate political and economic power in the country. It alone possessed the ability to manufacture currency, to establish interest rates, and to precipitate prosperity or depression. By its sole decision, money became available for industrial expansion and business growth, or it became withdrawn from circulation, making it impossible for entrepreneurs to launch new ventures, for couples to purchase houses, or people to gain employment. No other agency is more formidable or important to the everyday lives of American citizens, although few are aware of its function. Almost everything about the Federal Reserve System is shrouded in mystery. The chairman is appointed by the President of the United States, thereby eluding the impression that the 12 branches of the central bank are under the control of the federal government. But the person really in charge is the director of the Federal Reserve in New York, The very name of America's central bank is deceptive. It is not federal. The government owns no shares. It is a private, profit-making company. The shareholders are the private banks that united to it. The reserve system has no reserves. The money deposited is used by the directors of the 12 banks at their discretion. Finally, the system is not a system. It is a syndicate of bankers whose interests are often at odds with the welfare of the American people. The workings of the syndicate. When the government needs money, the Treasury Department issues bonds, which are sold by bond dealers. When the Fed wants to expand the money supply, it purchases the Treasury bonds from the bond dealers by the transfer of newly issued dollars. The dollars are created ex nihilo, out of nothing. They're not even printed. The dollars are made to materialize by the simple click of a mouse on the Fed computer. This practice is called open market operations, because the Fed buys the bonds on an open market from the bond dealers. The bonds, which the Fed now owns, become the reserves to back up the banking establishment's loans, and through fractional reserve lending, the same reserves are lent over and over again, thereby expanding the money supply and generating interest through each loan. Every act within this process represents an illusion. No material wealth is exchanged, and the value of the dollar is determined by fiat, that is, by a mere declaration of its worth by the Fed's Board of Governors. Lewis McFadden, who chaired the House Committee on Banking and Currency from 1920 to 1931, said at the time of his retirement, "When the Federal Reserve Act was passed, the people of the United States did not perceive that a world banking system was being set up here, a super state controlled by international bankers and international industrialists acting together to enslave the world for their own pleasure. Every effort has been made by the Fed to conceal its power, but the truth is, the Fed has usurped the government." The Panic of 1907. The origin of the Federal Reserve System dates back to the Panic of 1907, when snowballing bank runs prompted by Morgan-generated stories about the insolvency of the Knickerbocker Trust Company caused the collapse of banks throughout the country. Depositors were left with no means of recovering their savings. Wall Street brokers could not obtain the loans required for their daily transactions, and no central agency existed to clean up the mess. After creating the crisis, Morgan came to the rescue. He dispatched an army of clerks to troubled banks in order to look into their vaults and verify their assets. If the banks were solvent, he sent more clerks with satchels of gold coins, which he imported from Europe, to the banks in order to place them on display so that depositors would be assured of the safety of their money. On Wall Street, Morgan convinced several of his fellow bankers to offer $25 million in loans to brokers in order to keep the stock market afloat. He also met with U.S. Treasury Secretary George Cortelyou, who placed $25 million of Treasury funds in national banks and provided $36 million in small bills to meet the bank runs. By the middle of November, the working capital of the U.S. Treasury had dwindled down to $5 million. Maestro Morgan. Morgan's rescue measures resulted not only in averting a financial meltdown, but also in producing sizable interest payments on all the loans the House of Morgan provided to the nation's banks and to Wall Street. The measures also served to solidify Morgan's position as the leader of the American Money Trust and the driving force behind the emergence of the shadow government. As Morgan biographer Frederick Lewis Allen pointed out, "Where there had been many principalities, there was now one kingdom, and it was Morgan's." The panic caused Congress to approve the Aldrich Vreeland Act of 1908, which brought into being the National Monetary Commission. This, too, was a result of orchestration. Senator Nelson Aldrich, who received the appointment to head the commission, was J.P. Morgan's floor broker in the Senate. Aldrich's daughter, Abby, was married to John D. Rockefeller, Jr. His grandson, Nelson Aldrich Rockefeller, would become the vice president under Gerald Ford in 1974, while his grandson, David Rockefeller, would serve as the chief executive officer.